topological operators to it. Another way to put it is that if you have a symmetry, you can couple your theory with some operators in such a way that the correlation functions only depend on the topology of this operator, so you can deform them slightly and it leaves the correlation function in bounds. And so I like to think of this viewpoint on symmetry as having like three types of complementary consequences. The first one is this idea of generalized global symmetry, is that if you take the topological invariance of symmetry operators as their defining property, then you can be much more exotic than the usual ordinary symmetries with respect to groups. So an ordinary symmetry would assign operators to one-dimensional surfaces, and these operators, they would furnish representation of a group. But so, as I said, if you just take this, you just require the topological operators to be topological, then you can consider several types of generalization. The first one is that you can consider higher codimensional operators, and you can also allow for the operators to be non-invertible. And then you can combine these various generalizations. Another type of another consequence, which is obviously related, is that this definition gives you really an intrinsic way of defining a symmetry. Like you can define a symmetry without really referring to a theory, and without referring to the explicit action of symmetry operators on some fields. And also it gives you so then you have sort of an abstract formalism to encode the symmetry, which pertains to category theory. When you have such a higher category theory that will encode a symmetry, this will be the representative of some equivalence class, some Morita class of symmetry. So you can think of this as kind of different realizations of the same abstract symmetry. And I will mention how this is related to some generalized gauging procedure. Now the final consequence is this idea that we can leverage what we know about topological field theory to design a graphical or to design a calculus of topological defects. And more concretely, there was this, so one concrete way of realizing that is quite popular nowadays is this symmetry topological quantum field theory picture, where you can promote a theory that has a symmetry to a boundary theory of a higher dimensional topological field theory. And this is, we're gonna then leverage what we know about this specific TQFT to compute things about topological defects in the symmetric theory. Then we have sort of several consequences of this point of view is that, for instance, we can we can relate topological sector in the symmetric theory, which is what the talk today is gonna be about, to so-called topological excitations of the corresponding TQFT. Another type of consequence of this formalism is that it gives you access to a classification of gapped symmetric phases in terms of gapped or topological boundaries for the higher dimensional TQFT. So more concretely, let's see how this sort of looks like in the case of 1 plus 1D, which will be the focus of most of the talk. So we cannot play much with higher codimensionality in 1 plus 1 dimension, but we can ask for the operators to be non-invertible, or we can allow for the operators to be non-invertible. And how does it look like? Is that you have, what does it mean? Is that if you, for instance, insert two operators and you know put them next to each other, you can treat them as one big operator, and this operator will not be simple in general, it will decompose into simple operators. So you can think of, this is what happens with just, operators that would be labeled by irreducible representations for a group, for instance, where this would encode the tensor product of the representation. We want this, so this kind of fusion of lines to be associative, we want to have a so-called associator. And what it means is that if you insert a sort of network of lines, you can locally recouple this network. So you have access to an isomorphism that allows you to recouple this. So in that case, it's just like some kind of Bayes' transformation. So how do we formalize this? Like what is sort of, so this would be concretely in a theory, then like sort of if we want to formalize this idea, we need, so this is what the framework of fusion categories show up. And there are the assumptions that we deal with finite and semi-simple symmetries. And so throughout, I will make these assumptions that we talk about finite and semi-simple symmetries. And I mentioned earlier this so Morita class of different realization of the same symmetry. In that case, each representative will be labeled by some indecomposable module category over this fusion category. Now, the last item, so concretely, what is the corresponding TQFT that is relevant in 1+1 dimension? This is the Torre-Viro Barrett-Westbury TQFT we just heard about in the previous talk. And so concretely, what we have is, for instance, we have a classification of gapped C-symmetric phases in terms of indecomposable C-module categories. So this is what's going to label the gap boundary conditions of these Torre-Viro TQFT. And these topological sectors, so I will explain in a moment what I mean specifically about these topological sectors, will be in one-to-one correspondence with the simple objects in the so-called Drenfeld center of the input fusion category. And this is the quantum invariant that the Torre-Viro assigns to the circle.
Excuse me, question.
Yeah.
So, as correctly, so the usual description of symmetries, because when it corresponds to the fact when you have like trivial Torre-Viro, you have no truth anomaly. Usual symmetry G without a truth anomaly corresponds to a trivial symmetry TQFT.
Uh-huh, sure.
But it's only for finite groups. So what did like? We also have a.
So here, what I mean is that what I mean is that I'm thinking of. So what I'm referring to here is that if I have a theory, so a 1+1 dimension theory with a fusion category symmetry C, I can promote it to the boundary theory of Torre-Viro.
This covers also the case of ordinary, say.
Sure. So there would be digraph return.
Say finite group symmetry.
Digraph return in the case of finite group symmetry.
But it doesn't cover the case of, say, Lie group symmetry.
No, indeed. So this is why I'm saying I'm restricting to finite on a symbol. Okay, and so a lot of this work has been done in the continuum, but today I want to tell you about like sort of a realization of this framework directly on the lattice. So I mentioned this, I give you here the general picture, but like to be as concrete as possible, I will be focusing some on anomalous invertible symmetry. In that case, so we just said the relevant TQFT will actually correspond to digraph-Witten theory. I will talk about closed and open boundary conditions and the corresponding notion of topological sectors. Then I will talk about how we can gauge whenever this is possible, or maybe gauge some of the symmetry, and then the corresponding mapping of topological sectors. And finally, I will mention some higher dimension generalization. So the input here, the kind of fusion category we are interested in to describe an invertible symmetry with an anomaly would be this category of G-graded vector spaces. So the objects are just, so it's a graded vector space by a group. The simple objects are one-dimensional vector spaces labeled or graded by a group element. And morally, I can think of this as just being a group element for the sake of this presentation. The morphisms are given by grading preserving maps. And we have an associator, which means that when we take the tensor product, which is given by the group multiplication of these simple objects, the order in which we take this tensor product matters, and we have a non-trivial isomorphism. So concretely, what it is, this isomorphism is just going to be the trivial one times or just the associator in VEC, the usual associator in the category of vector spaces, times some Fricot cycle, so a normalized Fricot cycle. And I'm going to rely on these graphical calculus that we usually use in physics quite often in terms of string diagrams, where this picture, so the fusion of the tensor product of three objects, but I'm first doing the tensor product of G1 and G2, and then I will do G3. This is the different ordering, and I will be using this kind of graphical identities, where this is the Fricot cycle that the associator evaluates to. So what I want to do now is introduce a framework to systematically define 1+1 dimensional models that will have such symmetry. So the setup is the following one. For now, I'm going to assume I have an infinite chain. Later, I will talk about how to address boundary conditions. But let's say we have just a one-dimensional lattice, right, with sides. And I need to pick first an object in my category. And for simplicity, so the object is not simple, but I'm going to choose one where each simple object appear only once, just for it doesn't really matter, but it's just for to make the derivation slightly nicer. And then I need to have some kind of abstract local operators. So I will explain in a second what I mean by these abstract local operators. The first thing I'm going to do is to define the Hilbert space on which this model is defined. So we define this Hilbert space so in a graphical way, so I'm going to fully rely on this string diagram calculus, where I think of a state in this Hilbert space as being so a diagram of this form, right? So where each line represents an object in the category. And so every dot here represents a Hom space, and specifically a basis vector in the corresponding Hom space. So every labeling of such a diagram corresponds to a state in my Hilbert space. So more concretely, I can then write it down explicitly, where this is given in terms of Hom spaces like this, and the assumptions I made there make sure that this Hom space is always one-dimensional, so I don't have like kind of additional multiplicity showing up over there. Let's look at two specific cases. The first one is the one that typically the choice we make, where we basically allow for all possible simple objects here, and they all appear only once. And in that case, what happens is that this Hilbert space simplifies quite a bit. Actually, you have a tensor product Hilbert space. The idea is the following, is that so every time I have a junction of three lines, I have a corresponding Hom space, and this Hom space is going to be non-zero only when the product of the corresponding group variables is the identity, essentially. Some kind of flatness condition, if you want. And so if I specify the degrees of freedom on the blue lines, then it's going to fully specify what can go on the black line, right? Because every time the product will have to be the identity, and it's just group multiplication. And so effectively, I have a Hilbert space that is a tensor product Hilbert space, where I have, if you want, a degree of freedom sitting in the middle of the blue lines of the blue line scale. Another kind of extreme choice would be to choose this object X to be the identity. In that case, what it would do, so in the same spirit, right, since the product of the group variables have to be the identity around every vertex, it would force all of them to be the same. So this is typically a choice you would make if you wanted to define a model that was maybe some RG fixed point of the spontaneously symmetry broken phase, where it's a product state, where all the states are the same. So that's my Hilbert space. And separately, I can define the abstract Hamiltonian. Abstract in the sense that I define it in this graphical way, but this doesn't tell you exactly how they act until you specify their action on the Hilbert space. So generally speaking, this is a sum of local operators. So I here represents the sites, right? And N is just some flavor. So at the given site, I could have different operators of a different flavor. I represent this in this graphical way. So I'm using, again, this string diagram calculus. So exactly the same rule as before. Like every time you have a junction of three lines, you must impose the monoidal structure of your category, which is just group multiplications. And very concretely, this is the picture you want to have in mind. So you have a sum of diagrams, where here you see, like, if I have these two group elements G and GT, the multiplication force that tells me what must be the degrees of freedom at the top. And this can come with some weights, which are some complex coefficients. So how do you define then the action of these abstract operators on this Hamiltonian? Well, I'm going to do it in a graphical way. So the first step is to stack these diagrams on top of your state. Right? This operation is just, you just identify the degrees of freedom. So for instance, when I stack this operator on these two sides, the labels on the black lines along which I do this kind of gluing operations must be the same. And then I'm just going to rely on this operation I had before, the sort of this graphical way of defining the associator. I'm just going to employ repeatedly this operation. So I can do it once to change the recoupling of my lines. And then I can do it another time to change it further, where I have this sort of bubble that shows up, and you can sort of pop the bubble, where this is just this will just give you the identity morphism. And so after these operations, you're back at something that looks like this. What it means is that you're back at a state in the initial Hilbert space. So now, very explicitly, how does it do? I mean, if you don't like these graphical calculus, I can just give you the way we define them, where this is so a piece of my local operator, the complex coefficient, where you would just multiply by whatever the complex coefficient is. And so here you see, like for instance, what I was saying earlier is that if I'm specifying these two degrees of freedom there, the black line here has to be this sort of the ratio of the two group elements, if you want. And then the action, where it's just you have a left action on the side here in the middle, so I'm acting on this one. and you have this phase, this this complex with this additional phase, which is given by the cocycle. So let's see a very concrete example, like a baby example right away. So if I take the group to be Z2, right, and I'm choosing the trivial cohomology class, then I can consider a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of, so at every site, I have two flavors of operators. Okay, the notation is unfortunate. G here is just a coupling, it's not a group element, it's just a coupling constant. Now, the two operators I consider, so the first one is, it's simple. I'm just I'm essentially the degree of freedom in the horizontal end here is -1, and so what it's gonna do is that it's gonna take the group elements here, G and GT, and it's gonna multiply them by -1. So you're gonna kind of flip the degrees of freedom, the Z2 degrees of freedom, you're gonna flip between the two. And then I can consider this other one. This one acts diagonally, so it doesn't act, it acts trivially on the group elements if you want, but there is a coefficient here, which is just the sign of the one on the left. Now you can either convince yourself immediately that what the final result is going to be, or you can just go through the procedure before. And what you find is the transverse field Ising model, which is really the simplest 1+1D model you can write down. So the X, so sorry, I should clarify, these are the Pauli operators. The X operator, it just does the flip of your degree of freedom that is on the site. And the ZZ here, you're going to collect a -1 every time the guy over here is minus. Okay, another example now with an anomaly. So still the group is going to be Z2. Now I'm going to pick the non-trivial cohomology class. And I'm going to take this to a bit of a funny Hamiltonian, but there is only one type of operator in that case. And I really spell it out instead of using this sum, where I have just these two configurations. So here what it means in particular is that the configuration +1, -1, I just throw it away, right? I just don't allow for it. And then this guy, then the cocycle actually show up, and then if you write it down explicitly in terms of these Pauli operators, in terms of spin operators, you have a Hamiltonian that looks like this. And this is a Hamiltonian that people are considering. It's usually a one piece of the kind of general Hamiltonian people consider when talking about the Z2 anomaly in 1+1D.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
So why is it in the anomalous case we don't get the symmetry breaking case? Because if you have Z2 anomaly, it's a Hamiltonian.
So I will talk more concretely later about the role of the anomaly. But so what's the question? Like
in the first case, you have a Hamiltonian with the parameter G, and if you tune the parameter, you can get
I. Yeah, yeah. So this would be the spontaneously symmetry broken part, right? But there is no anomaly there, right?
Yeah, but so in the second case, you can also have a symmetry breaking state of, you know, of if you have Z2 anomalous Z2, you can also have a symmetry breaking state. But that's not appear in this.
I mean, this is just one toy model. I mean, I took this Hamiltonian is a bit random. I mean, I could have added something else. I'm not saying this is the most general type of Hamiltonian. Yeah, no, this is just one piece. This is what I was saying. It's like one piece of a more general Hamiltonian you can write down, just to illustrate how the graphical calculus works. Okay, so we have these two Hamiltonians. Now, how do we talk about the symmetries of these Hamiltonians? So same story, we're going to do it graphically. And so here, the symmetry operators, so what they are, so like generally speaking, you can think of this as topological lines whose support extend over the whole Hilbert space at a given time. So this red line here, this represents this topological line, which is labeled by a group element, and it acts on the whole Hilbert space. Now, the action of this topological line on a state in my Hilbert space is done like this, where first I can just absorb the line. This is just using the group multiplication. I can absorb the red line in the blue line, and then the line in the middle is just going to be the result of the multiplication of the corresponding degrees of freedom. And then I can use my graphical calculus. I can move my lines around. I can use my sort of recoupling theory of my lines using, again, the associator in this graphical way. So you can go from this picture to this picture. And then, same as before, you can kind of pop this bubble, and you're back at the configuration. You're back at a state in the initial hyperspace. Yeah?
Why did you write the Hamiltonian as acting from above, but the symmetry operator acting from below?
Yes, so I will mention this later, but because ultimately the blue line here is going to have some bimodule structure, and you're going to have, this will be acting, let's say, from the left, the other one from the right, And so naturally, you have this kind of left-right action. I mean, this is a graphic. You could. There are different graphical calculus you can use to define this action. But in that case, this is the one that is closer related to this bimodular structure. So now, very concretely, again, I'm just going to write down explicitly what it is. And so, what this operator it just acts from the right by right multiplication, and you pick up some phase factor, which are again given by these cocycles. And the fact that this is a cocycle, like you see the role of the cocycle condition concretely, then when you want to check now explicitly that this operator is commutes with the Hamiltonian, you have to use repeatedly the cocycle condition. So again, I'm going back to my examples just to show how it looks like. So the group is same as before, Z2, and this is the Hamiltonian, the transverse field Ising model. And if I So there was no cocycle, so then the action of the symmetry is just this right multiplication. And so you can, in the basis I chose, this is just this Pauli operator. We just basically swap the two. If you act with minus one, it's just going to swap your 2 degrees of freedom. Now, if I have an anomaly, so this was the Hamiltonian I had, then you get this. Well, you can show that when you collect everything, you get something that looks like that. So you have a non-local symmetry operator. And basically, the contribution from the cocycle, you can absorb it in this funny-looking coefficient. Okay, so now let me talk about boundary conditions. So far, I was working with like infinite case, right? And now let's say we have a finite chain and we want to close this chain. In that case, we're going to have to choose some boundary condition. So here, the boundary condition, we're going to have what we call symmetry twisted boundary condition. So if you just close the chain and you don't do anything, this is where we would get a periodic boundary condition. But you can also insert symmetry defect. So symmetry defect here, it's a topological line, the same topological line we use to define the symmetry operators. But instead of acting on the whole Hilbert space, this one is defined at one point, and then it extends in the time direction. So how does it look like? So this is this topological line I'm referring to. It's kind of defined at one point, and then it extends in the time direction like this. So concretely, if this, so everything is labeled by group elements here still. If I choose this group element to be the identity, then it means that these 2 degrees of freedom are the same. And so effectively, this is just the same as having periodic boundary conditions. I'm closing my chain by identifying the degrees of freedom, and I'm not doing anything else.
So excuse me. Where's the boundary in this picture?
Well, the boundary is, this is kind of closed here, you imagine with, let's say, periodic boundary condition at the back. So here, the boundary condition I'm talking about is this one. So I'm imagining, like, I'm closing my chain, and instead of just maybe identifying these two pieces of strands, I can insert a symmetry defect in between.
So this is a periodic geometry.
So it's periodic at the back here. Yeah? This is what the drawing is trying to suggest. It's like on the circle.
The symmetry defect.
The symmetry defect is this one.
So why do
it goes in the time direction. So you have this, your chain is a circle, right? So you imagine a cylinder, right? You have it on the circle, and the topological effect is in the other direction.
It's like the Z twisted
sector. Yeah, yeah.
Why do you call it boundary condition? I understand. There's no spatial boundary.
So boundary condition. I'm calling it in the same way we call like periodic antiperiodic, right? If you have an like periodic antiperiodic, when you close, you take the Ising model. When you define it on the closed chain, you have different types of boundary condition. You can just close it by identifying the degrees of freedom, or you can put additional twists so that instead of identifying them, maybe you first multiply them by something.
Boundary condition. Okay.
Well, in the condensed matter literature, this is the common. Yeah.
Z-twisted boundary condition. If you snip this open at the Z-line, then this is just a chain where you've set the two ends to have a boundary condition. They agree with
it's a ring, but with like one line. If I understand your picture correctly,
yeah.
What you mean is it's a ring with one line coming in, and that line is a twist.
Yeah, it's like a defect.
Yeah, it is a defect. Yeah, yeah.
Say the circle geometry with a defect. I wouldn't call it.
Sure. So to make contact with the condensed matter literature, I'm going to show an example where we have, for instance, this periodic antiperiodic boundary condition. This is just an example of a symmetry twisted boundary condition.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Suppose we take a 2 plus 1D in topological order, the model, like the Peirce quantum double or string net, with a gapped boundary. So usually the total Hamiltonian has an interaction between the boundary and the bulk, of course. But if we rewrite on an effective Hamiltonian of the boundary only, I think that Hamiltonian is worse.
This is not exactly what I'm doing here, because I'm not trying to, so far I haven't chosen really a gap boundary conditions for the underlying topological model, right? Where I'm not, what if I understand correctly, what you're suggesting is that you could say, okay, I'm choosing, let's say, the toric code, I have, let's say, the rough boundary, and then I can say, okay, is there an effective Hamiltonian that represents this rough boundary? This is not necessarily the case. Here, these Hamiltonians, I don't know, they don't represent a specific phase, they can be in any possible phase, they can be, it's very generic. It's like just a Hamiltonian that has a symmetry.
Yeah, I think that Hamiltonian has a symmetry, acted on by this kind of defects.
Yeah, so, okay, let's just see how it looks like. So, now the question is, how do the symmetric operators act in the presence of these defects? So in the spirit of the graphical calculus, you have to accommodate for the presence of this defect here, and you have to promote your original topological lines to the network of this form. Well, now you can stack this piece on that part, and then you can use the graphical calculus. So again, we're just going to repeatedly use this associator in order to absorb the line in that part. But what we see immediately when we do that is that these operators typically change the boundary condition. It's going to act on the symmetry on the twist defect. It's going to act on it. And so only so if I'm choosing my boundary condition labeled by some group element z, only the ones the symmetry operators labeled by group elements in the centralizer of Z will preserve the boundary condition.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
In terms of the graph calculus, but does it mean like
the boundary function? Yeah, so let's just see one example. The example will come after this. Well, okay, let me do the example first then. So the transverse filizing model, okay? So we have only two cases, right? We have only two symmetry defects, the one labeled by the trivial one and the one labeled by the non-trivial group element. If you label the one by, this is the identity, right? Then basically these two degrees of freedom here are identified. So this is what I was talking about, is that you close your bond, you close your chain by just identifying the degrees of freedom. Then if you write down the Hamiltonian, so in principle, here we have kind of one more, we have two degrees of freedom, but they are forced to be the same, and therefore effectively I have a Hilbert space with only n degrees of freedom, and if I write down the Hamiltonian on there, this is just the usual transverse filizing model with periodic boundary condition. Now, if I choose rather the non-trivial topological line, same story here, now these two degrees of freedom now they're not the same, they have to be opposite, but effectively I still have a Hilbert space of and degrees of freedom, because these ones are not free. Once I choose one, the other one is forced to be something else. And so effectively, on this Hilbert space, I have this Hamiltonian, which is the transverse filizing model with n-periodic boundary condition. The symmetries in that case, before talking about the symmetries, let me go back to the previous slide. So now what we have to ask is that, so we have these operators, right? So as I said, they act, they can potentially change, they typically change the boundary condition. And so my Hilbert space has the structure of a module over the action of these objects, this tube-like object. And so to understand what is exactly there, so we want to then to understand the algebra of these objects. And so what we do is that I'm going to stack two of them. I'm going to use, graphical calculus to recouple the lines. So you're going to collect a bunch here of factors depending on the Fricot cycle, and then you can simplify it to something of that form. This defines an algebra, which is isomorphic to the twisted Grünfeld double, which we heard about before. Well, here I'm using an alternative definition. So this would be the action groupoid that we heard about before. So the topological sectors, what do I talk about topological sectors? I mean the combination of a choice of boundary condition and then charged vectors for whatever symmetry remains. So I'm choosing, so the first thing to notice is that, so as I said, if you, once you pick a boundary condition, only in the symmetry operators in the centralizer will preserve the boundary condition. Yes?
So would it be accurate to say that kind of the essence of the idea here is that this is sort of like, I can think of this as like an action of an anion sort of coming in from some bulk theory?
That's normally the idea, where you have, if you think of the anion as like the diion with like an electric and a magnetic part, the magnetic part would be the twist effect for the boundary condition, and the electric part would be the charge sectors that remain. So the symmetry, so we have orbits of symmetry boundary conditions, the ones that are related by the action of this operator. So these are given by conjugacy classes of the group. And then for any representative of this conjugacy class, and we look at the corresponding centralizer, this gives us the symmetry that remains, the symmetry that preserves the boundary condition. And the irreps of this centralizer will give you the charge sectors. And so what we recover are, well, the representation, the irreducible representations of the Drinfeld double, which the category of which is equivalent to the Drinfeld center of our input category. So this is when I mentioned at the beginning that the topological sectors were given in one-to-one with simple object, the Drinfeld center. This is how you get it in this example. Okay, and so this is, as I said also, this is the invariant that the Dijkstra frequency reassigns to the circle. And so physically, this is the same data that labels so the anions of the corresponding Hamiltonian realization. So now let me, about this example. So this example is actually very simple in the sense that the boundary condition does not actually affect the symmetry. So whichever choice you make, you still have the same symmetry at the end. It's just a Z2 symmetry, which in that case is just this product of party X acting on all the sides. So they, in both cases, we have the two same charge sectors, or then even. And so in total, we have four topological sectors given periodic, antiperiodic, even, or odd. Okay. So now I want to talk about open boundary conditions. And so this is where the topological boundary conditions of the underlying TQFT show up. So we know that the topological boundary conditions of Dijkstra frequency theory are classified by the indecomposable module categories over the input fusion category. So this is it's very similar to what we heard about before. So the data of this module category, what it is, it's a subgroup, and then a trivializing two-code chain. So it's a subgroup in such a way that there is a two-code chain that trivializes the three-code cycle when you restrict it to this subgroup. It may or may not exist. This is where the anomaly part is that you may not have such a choice of group A. If there is one, then the corresponding category, the set of simple objects of this category, is given by the transitive G set, which is just the quotient of G by A. And we have a notion of module associator. So maybe let me first show it graphically. So here, so this blue line here represents then this module degrees of freedom, right? They are acted upon by these black lines, which are the objects in the category, right? And the order in which you act matters. So we have a relation very similar to what we had before, where these two diagrams are related by a coefficient here, which you can get from psi. So it's a three-code chain, or depending on, it's a two-code chain valued in the space of functions on the quotient, which depends on so the two-code elements G1, G2, and then Ra, which is an element of the set of cosets. So, I don't know why it's written symmetry twisted boundary conditions, but now I can define open boundary conditions. So I can define my chain on, so before we considered the case where it has a topology of a circle, now this is of a finite line. And on either side, at the two endpoints of the lines, I can make different choices of indecomposable module categories, which corresponds to different choices of open boundary conditions. So the Hilbert space, how it looks like. So the bulk of the Hilbert space is the same as before. But now on the boundary, I have this. So it's two possible choices of module categories. And the objects on the boundaries are objects in these module categories. Now the symmetry operators, as before, the same way we had to accommodate for the presence of symmetry defects in the case of closed boundary conditions. Here we have to accommodate for the presence of these boundary conditions. And so the operators, the way they look like, these topological lines, now they act by it looks like this, where you have an action of the line on degrees of freedom at the boundary. Okay, and so we have a story that is very similar to what we had before. Is that if you stack this object on there, then you use the graphical calculus to define explicitly its action. You realize that in general, the topological line will change the open boundary conditions. Okay. So only the ones labeled by group elements that stabilize this pair of cosets will give you will preserve the boundary conditions. So this is for the action of these lines on the qubit space. Then you can ask, then you can check, okay, what do we need for this to commute with the Hamiltonian? This is where we need to use, we're going to use the coherence relation of this module associator, so it's some Pentagon equation. And this, the fact that you have such equation, this is what tells you that this is only possible if this the cocycle is trivialized on these subgroups. So in particular, this is the idea that we cannot define a symmetry-preserving boundary. So when you have an anomaly, you cannot find you cannot find there is no choice here that would preserve the whole symmetry. So now we have to do something similar. We have a Hilbert space. It has a structure of a module over the action of these lines. And so we ask, okay, what is the algebra of these lines? And so we do something very similar. We stack two of those. Then we're going to use a couple of times the module associators of both boundary conditions. And you get an algebra like this, where you have here a coefficient. So that depends on all the data we have. So the input associator and the psi and phi that specify the module associators of the two boundary conditions. And now we can ask, okay, what are the topological sectors? So the first thing is that we ask for equivalence classes of boundary conditions. So specifically, we ask for orbits of, so these cosets specify the boundary conditions. We ask for orbits under the action of this line. And it turns out that these orbits are in one-to-one correspondence with these double cosets. And very concretely, if I take a representative of these double cosets, then the corresponding representative of the orbit is given by this. Now the charge sectors, so we ask what are the symmetry operators that preserve these boundary conditions? So what is the stabilizer of this orbit? This is given by this group here. And this coefficient here gives you some Schur multiplier, and so you get a projective represent, like a charge sectors will be given by projective representations of this stabilizer. And so if you put everything together, the category that represents all this data. On the one hand, so you have this here, this is the part that represents the orbits. And then for every possible orbit, you have the charge sectors that are given by projective representations of the corresponding stabilizer. And we recover, so an object that is well known, which is the category of module functors formed between the two module categories. I will say a bit more about this module category, but just to say that we recover a structure that we know and that showed up before in the study of topological models, because this is exactly the data that encodes the domain wall point-like excitations for the underlying Hamiltonian realization. Okay. So again, an example very concretely. So in the case of the Ising model, if I start from Z2, I only have two choices of indecomposable module category. There is one that is sort of trivial, which is VEC, and there is the category itself, which is a module over itself. So graphically, what it means when you choose these boundary conditions here, this is what we call the free boundary conditions, that basically you're not making any choices here. You have nothing on these degrees of freedom, and like, there is no, we're not fixing a degree of freedom at the boundary. And so the corresponding Hamiltonian is essentially the same as, I mean, it looks exactly as before. The symmetry is completely preserved. And so we have two charge sectors that are given. Again, we still have odd and even charge sectors. And these charge sectors, we can check. So they are labeled by representations of the group. And this is, you can check that this is equivalent to this category of module functors from VEC to itself. Now, the case of fixed boundary conditions, it's the other choice of indecomposable module category. So I'm choosing fixed on both sides. I could also choose free and fixed, but I'm choosing fixed on both sides. And then what you see, again, if you work on some like, okay, what is the corresponding effective Hilbert space, and you just write down explicitly how the Hamiltonian look like on this effective Hilbert space, you find so the familiar situation when we have a fixed boundary conditions for the transverse field Ising model, where you have this additional terms over here. So here what we have is that in principle you can choose, so it, basically the idea is that the boundary the degrees of freedom on the boundary, you can fix them to be one specific group element. Then when you, so you can have a, you could have a plus one, minus one, minus one, plus one, plus one, plus one, minus one, minus one. But then when you act with the symmetry operators, this will like flip them simultaneously. So you have actually only two orbits of possible degrees of freedom. And so these two orbits correspond to the two simple objects in this, in the category VEC, where I think of it here as the category of module functors from VEC Z2 to itself. How much time do I have left? Okay, so why do we care about these topological sectors? Okay, so when you have these topological sectors, what it tells you is that your Hamiltonian is going to have a block decomposition, right? And the blocks are going to label by the topological sector. Now, the reason we care is for the because of the following generalization. So I'm going back to the infinite case for now, where what I can do is I can do almost exactly what I did before, but now, so my Hilbert, when I define my Hilbert space, instead of choosing these diagrams that are only labeled by group elements in the input category, I can choose the degrees of freedom labeling these blue lines to be object in an indecomposable module category over the input. Why would I want to do that? So the idea is that I'm changing the Hilbert space, but I'm keeping my abstract Hamiltonian that I had at the beginning completely intact. And when you just change the Hilbert space in this way, what it amounts to is actually performing a gauging of the corresponding symmetry, or actually a twisted gauging if you choose some psi, whenever this is possible. So now the question is, after you did this operation, the symmetry might not be quite the same. So graphically, this is exactly what we had before. But now that not everything is labeled by group elements anymore. So, yeah.
On the last slide with the twisted gauging, so in the field theory, I often think of the twisted gauging as like stacking an SPT and then gauging. Is there a similar interpretation here?
Yes, I mean, you could do a case where you don't kind of gauge everything. You don't really gauge anything, you just insert this twist, which would amount to just spacing an SPT. So you can also do that.
What does it mean to insert the twist? Would it mean like modifying the Hamiltonian, like adding the fixed point SPT term, or?
What I mean is that you can, for instance, let's say there is no alpha. You can always choose, in that case, VEC as a module category, right? So then you write down the model in terms of this. And then I could choose a VEC, but like a different fiber functor. I could choose VEC, so I could, the category is still VEC, but it has a different module associator. And this difference is just given by a choice of a two-core cycle. So this would amount to just pasting an SPT and not gauging anything. When you do the combination of like kind of changing the group and inserting the twist, it would be a twisted gauging.
Thanks.
So how does it look like? So briefly, now I have this module degrees of freedom over there. So the topological lines at first, I don't really know what they are labeled by. But so let's see, you know, if we can kind of work it out, right? So in order to have a picture that looks like this, what I need to be able to do is first is kind of to absorb this red line in these blue lines. And this means that I need to have a notion of these red lines must act on these blue lines, and I'm going to encode that in some functors. I need to have a functor between the module category itself. This will give me an action on this red line on these blue lines. Then I need to have a way of passing these red lines sort of through the black lines. I need to be able to recouple these lines. So I need to have some kind of isomorphism that allows me to do this. And this isomorphism is a module structure for this functor. So what it is that basically the action of the functor must commute with the action of the group elements on the corresponding module degrees of freedom. So you must be able to sort of take out the action of the group elements. And if you have this, you can graphically do something that looks like that, where you can change sort of the order of the action. You can swap them. And this is exactly the kind of graphical identity I'm using to go from here to there. So that gives you the action. And then you want these operators to commute with the Hamiltonian. This enforces that this module structure satisfies some coherence relation, which is some Pythagorean axiom involving the module associator. And this will guarantee it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So what do we have? What does it show? It shows that the symmetry operators, or rather the symmetry I get after doing the gauging, is given by what we call the Morita dual of the input with respect to this module. And And this is, so this is the category of endofunctors or module endofunctors of this module category. Now, what is very crucial is that this, so this Morita dual, so for different choices of module categories, they all have the same center. So what it means that they have essentially the same topological sector. And this is the, what is key. So how does it look like for the transverse filizing model? So I'm going back, so I have, I'm looking at the closed case with the closed boundary condition. And here, this is the one we talked about, right? So I'm choosing the module category to be itself. So this is exactly the Hamiltonian we had before and in with closed boundary conditions. So depending on, we may, the sign here depends on the choice of boundary condition we make. Okay. On the other hand here, we have, I make a different choice for these blue degrees of freedom. When I'm choosing the module category to be vague, we basically say it's kind of trivial. So there are sort of nothing on these blue lines. The only degrees of freedom, they kind of sit at the level of this of these black lines. And then if you work it out, what you find is that you find this Hamiltonian. Like if I fix some basis and I'm this in terms of party operators, this is how it looks like. And what is interesting is that this original Hamiltonian, so it has the symmetry we had before with respect to this party X operators. But this dual Hamiltonian now, if you choose your basis, like if you fix your basis, then you see that it's rather generated by this poly Z operators. So you have, and this is reminiscent to the fact that the symmetry, which is the Morita dual with respect to this trust and module category here would be rep Z2, well here it would be vec Z2, okay? So why do we care about the topological sectors? Is because on the total Hilbert space, this operation here, if you try to write an operator that would map this Hamiltonian onto itself, it wouldn't be unitary. Right? What it would do is that it would actually project onto the singlet sectors of the symmetry. So one way to do this is that if you try to express this degree of freedom here in terms of the original one, you realize that you can only have states in such a way that the product of the group elements, the corresponding group elements, is the identity. Another way to put it is that if you express this operator here, so the duality mapping would map these two operators to this one. So when I look at the symmetry operators, and I'm taking the product of all these guys, they would cancel 2 by 2 throughout this mapping. And so this would tell you that you're forced to be in the singlet sector of the symmetry. But it doesn't mean, so then it's a bit problematic because then it tells you that if you want to express the previous parameter in the original one, you can only do it in the singlet sector. So how do you access the other sectors? But this is where you have to change the boundary condition. And basically you can show that if you choose here the anti-periodic boundary condition, it will send you then to the odd sector of this model, and vice versa, if I choose the odd sector here, it will send me to the anti-periodic boundary condition here. So basically you have a mapping between all the possible sectors. And as long as you are between compatible sectors, then you can write down this mapping as a unitary. And so effectively, the whole point is that once you classify your topological sectors and you check how the sectors are mapped into each other under this mapping, then you can actually write it down as a unitary, which meaning you can relate the spectra of the Hamiltonian. So this is a very briefly another example that was kind of mentioned maybe yesterday, but more generally, here the starting point was always like vec G of some group, but you can actually be much more general. And in particular, you could choose representations of a group as an input, and then you can look at the kind of dualities you can get by changing like kind of module categories. And so I'm not gonna go into the detail, but basically there is a choice of abstract Hamiltonian and with this Hilbert space where you recover the Heisenberg model, and then if you choose the module category here, a specific module category. You get a model, and this model actually we know from the construction that it must have a non-invertible symmetry given by representations of the group. So this is a more complicated type of model, but we can relate, then we want to relate again the sectors of these models, and once you do, you can actually write down the mapping between the Hamiltonians as between each sectors as a unitary. Okay, so I'm not gonna go through that, but basically a similar story happened in, yeah.
For the last slide, how would the Hamiltonians change if you had a non-trivial row?
Yeah, so indeed, here I'm, okay, so for instance, here if you choose a two-dimensional representation, you get something a bit complicated. You get like a four-body term, which you cannot really simplify. This is a complicated type of boundary condition. And there is basically, there is a, it just turns out that if you choose this complicated boundary condition in some, let's say the event sector in this one, charge sectors, it's mapped to another, like the boundary conditions here labeled by the order two element in the group.
Okay, and then, sorry, one more question.
Yeah.
Is so for the Z2 case, the Hilbert space sizes didn't depend on the twist. But
yeah. So
here.
Yeah. So indeed, like in the Abelian case, you can kind of always go to effective Hilbert space. You can, instead of modifying the Hilbert space, you can just modify the Hamiltonian. But here, you cannot really get away with it. Like, since you have like a non-Abelian twist, if you want, you have to have these 2 degrees of freedom there, and so effectively, you have a bigger Hilbert space. And maybe there is a way to kind of resolve this and then go back to like the same number of sets. But in general, this would be the picture. We would always have 2 degrees of freedom there that are connected via the symmetry defect.
Great, thanks.
Okay, so I will skip the comments about higher dimensions, but we can do similar things, and we have the kind of categorifications of the corresponding structure that show up. And in particular, there was an interesting case where it's like defining a 2+1D model on a cylinder, where you have combinations of closed and open boundary conditions, and this is where the higher center of the corresponding input fusion two category shows up. But so let me conclude by just giving you like a quick summary. So I focused on like one type of example, but the story is actually it works much more generally. So what is the take-home message is that if you start from some fusion category, you can build some abstract Hamiltonian using this. And then the action of this, the actual Hamiltonian, will depend on the choice of a Hilbert space, and this Hilbert space will depend on the choice of module category. Once you made that choice, then the symmetry of the resulting Hamiltonian, we know by construction that this is given by the Morita dual of the input with respect to this module category. The topological sectors are given by the Drinfeld center of the symmetry category in the closed case. In the open case, we have two categories of modules over this. Then you can write down, given two different choices of module categories, you can actually write down explicitly an operator that transforms one Hamiltonian into the other. It's going to be labeled by some module functor between the corresponding module categories. And once you address the way the sectors are going to are mapped onto each other, invoking the equivalence between the corresponding Drinfeld centers, you can promote these duality operators to actually isometries that then relate the spectra of the corresponding Hamiltonians. So this is for the closed case. In the open case, we haven't quite worked out yet how the sectors are mapped onto each other under duality, and therefore the mapping then of the analog of this relation. And of course, the big question is how exactly this looks like in higher dimension. I will stop here. Thank you.
My question, I guess, is how you would interpret these ingredients if you had a category of, say, the category of representations of a quantum group. So how does the Hamiltonian look like?
So an example where we can do, for instance, if you start from representation of UQSL2, you can recover temporally lib out of these constructions. And in particular, if you change, you have then two different choices of module categories, so itself, or you can choose VEC as well. The corresponding duality is this IRF vertex duality that was studied in the integrability literature a while back. So we recover also this type of mappings.
Right, but I guess, from the module category, you get some type of algebra, and then you cook up a Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
So is there an easy way to like reinterpret what the Hamiltonian you would get from this?
You can write it down explicitly. So in the case where you choose VEC, basically this is when you would get the usual temporally lib algebra. And then if you choose rather the module category that is itself, you get something that is, well, not super nice to write down, but it was written down explicitly by Pasquier, for instance, in this IRF vertex duality papers, and you can recover that. It's just like, typically when you choose like representations and then the module category to be representation, I mean itself, right? Then you get like these objects that are not very nice because you have to express them in terms of CJ symbols, and it's not very nice looking, but you have a general way of writing them.
All right, so there's no nice
answered. It's all right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You mentioned this mapping between the Grenfell Center and the topological sectors for the closed case. For the example of, let's say, RepG, is this mapping one-to-one, meaning if I looked at the charge sectors within each topological sector, would the anions like show up once and not more than once?
So you have a topological, so you mean, like, let's say you choose a boundary condition, and then you ask whether, if you look at all possible charge sectors, whether, yeah, so it's possible that you have more one than one charge sector, but it comes down to the fact that the simple object in the Grenfell center, as an object of the input category, it's not necessarily simple. So you have this phenomenon where you have, it can be a simple topological sector, but then it corresponds to, for instance, a non-simple boundary condition, where you have, like, several defects there.
So in your construction of gauging, so basically if you have a Fabian characteristics, you just pick an indecomposable same module, and you take objects of that multi-category as the physical gauge gives. So that if a Fabian category has an indecomposable multi-category, that basically means it's gappable. Like, it's another fiber function, which means this symmetry can be gapped. There is a gap realization of symmetry. But so there is this discussion that, so for Fujian category symmetry, gaugeable and gappable are different, which means you can have a non-invertible symmetry that is ungappable, but it's still gaugeable.
So here I'm taking, so this is the point of view where if I have a fiber functor, then I can gauge it. That's what I'm aware of the distinction you're talking about. Here I'm taking the point of view where I want to have a fiber functor.
So in principle, it does not have a fiber functor.
Well, then I wouldn't talk about gauging. I wouldn't be able to gauge the whole symmetry. This is the requirement I need, yeah.
Do you have any comments about generalizing it for continuous symmetries? These models, generalizing the models.
So maybe just worth pointing out, like, for instance, with the Heisenberg model, it's possible to have a model that has a continuous symmetry, but then we only look at like a finite subsymmetry of it. So it doesn't mean we cannot address, of course, models that would have, I would say, an accidental continuous symmetry. The main problem with continuous symmetry is that the Morita theory, I mean, as far as I know, it's a bit, it's very delicate, right? Like trying to go compute what is the Morita dual, the analog of the Morita dual in the case of a continuous symmetry. I think pretty much an open question as far as I know, so this is why we restrict to that case. Yeah.
Last question.
Okay. Is there a way to get the critical Ising model, but with the full Ising fusion category acting on it? I know that if you feed it the Ising fusion category, you can get Ising direct sum Ising or something like that. Is there a way to get rid of that other copy?
No, I think you have whatever you do. It's like either you try to do so you do it the way Frank Shower and Nassim Seibach did it, where you really try to make your Kramers-Vanier being acting on site and making it a symmetry, and then you realize that when you stack twice this operator, it's not quite the fusion rule of Ising, right? Or you really insist that it's given by the fusion rules of Ising, but then exactly as you said, you essentially get two copies of the model sort of shifted by half a site that they send onto each other, and so as far as I know, it's not possible to have just like the plain Hamiltonian and the like genuine action by the Ising category.
If you were okay with that though, and you had a bunch of Isings and then you gauge some module category, let's say two, would I get kind of the same answer on the other side, but a direct sum of the things I would expect? Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I mean, we consider examples, for instance, where you can couple, or you can take two critical Ising chains and then do like gauge the diagonal, take the module category that is the diagonal, with the diagonal action, and then you get like two copies of, I mean, it is possible. You can still deal with it. You can still deal with it, but it's not maybe quite as, yeah, it's not exactly what we want. You want maybe.
We have one question on. Let's see. You can go ahead.
Well, not. Not really. I mean, in that framework, it doesn't matter much. I mean, the actual computation, like if you compute the Morita dual of VEC S3 with respect to VEC, it's much easier than doing it the other way. But practically speaking, it doesn't really make much difference. Actually, if you want to have like nice looking Hamiltonians, it's usually preferable to start from Rep G rather than VEC G. So this is not a problem in general. I can't think of any specific problem right now. It's no.
Okay. I think it's good here.